Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes, and we're back again for another two-hour episode of Zero Point Radio. My background is as a psychologist, as a clinical and forensic psychologist, but through my life I've studied esoteric, mystical, and spiritual teachings, as well as always had an interest in science and science philosophy. Particularly, I study the issues of human consciousness. And within academic psychology, I'd been indoctrinated, in a sense, into a psychology that has dismissed the idea of human beings as having a spirit or soul, and which regards us mainly as purely material, biological beings. So in modern times, there was no psychology of the spirit or soul. And I became interested in the psychology of consciousness. And what is that most enigmatic thing is human consciousness, which is really an unknown in modern science. But the whole predominant teaching of modern times has been the belief that the material brain produces the mind and consciousness within the head. And that consciousness somehow is produced by the material biological processes in the brain and mind and centered in the head. As I studied myself through my life and read widely in spiritual psychologies, including things, the Gurdjieff Uspensky teaching, Blavatsky and the secret doctrine, Kabbalistic and yogic teachings, so I've studied for 30 years of the occult literature trying to understand what the mystics say about the nature of self. And I find the primary teaching is what I call now the heart doctrine, that the true nature of self is connected to the human heart. And consciousness originates somehow through the higher dimensional physics of the human heart. Okay, so I compare my work, the heart doctrine, to the head doctrine. Yogi teachings define self-realization as the dissolution of the false mind into the lotus of the heart. So I'm interested in the nature of self and the concept of whether or not a human being has an individual I. Like in modern science, we wouldn't conceive that a human being has an individual I. Francis Crick, in his book on consciousness called The Astonishing Hypothesis, says that we're just a pack of neurons. Or another scientist might say we're just a pack of cells. Or another might say we're just electromagnetic processes in the brain. So if that is so, there is no individual self. All there is are these different processes. When psychologists in modern times try to understand self, what self is, they think it has to do with certain parts of the prefrontal cortex, and that our experience of self has to do with certain cortical areas. From a mystical perspective, all this is nonsense and shows the ignorance of self. And the process of mystical attaining is to begin to awaken to the experience of self within the heart. The self within the heart is described as the sun of the body. And what I came to understand through my studies over time was the idea of taking this literally and looking into what could be the physics and metaphysics of such a self within the heart. My current writing is on Blavatsky's secret doctrine and the metaphysics of Blavatsky from 1888 and how that compares with new ideas emerged in modern physics about holography and the holographic model in physics. In both views, in Blavatsky's views, the human heart has a deep higher dimensional physics to it. And in a way, we all have a zero-point center. Blavatsky in The Secret Doctrine says, zero points are the materials by which the gods and other invisible powers clothe themselves in bodies. So it's like every living being has this kind of center I, this zero point. So the idea is that there is an I, some element. And this is very incredibly small. It's a zero point. It's so small it kind of disappears from view. You might imagine this as a divine source emanation or a divine spark. That's the concept. Those are the words that Shirley MacLaine talks about, the God spark, the idea that we all have the God spark within us. Well, what if that's serious? What if we do have a God spark? What would be the physics? What would the God spark be in modern physics? Well, there's answers to those kinds of questions, and that those are my interests, is trying to understand how this physics of higher dimensional existence might work out. And all has to do with trying to understand the nature of space and what I would call the ethers of space. So I would say, in a way, we as living beings all have a zero-point center within the higher dimensional physics of the heart. And that is what self is. And that consciousness somehow is illumination that emerges from the heart, and it's spread through the body through a system of subtle channels and centers. So I'm interested in this higher dimensional model of what it is, what we are as human beings. Okay, so every day, every show, I like to give a bit of a talk on zero-point teachings and bring it back to these main themes of what the zero-point radio show is about. It's trying to explain some of the consciousness and psychology of the heart, and looking at creation physics and metaphysics and such, and articulating this zero-point teaching. And over the last few months, our focus has shifted quite a bit in terms of trying to attend more to the greater problems of humankind that are just so terrible at this point throughout the planet here, and what unbelievable things have happened in our own countries, the deceptions and the manufactured madness of modern times. So the last months or so, we've been featuring a series of guests and addressing some of the broader issues of contemporary humankind. And I have such a guest on today who I'll introduce in a moment. And I'm going to introduce a co-host, James Moffat. Jim, are you there?
I am.
You're welcome.
Hi.
Any comment, Jim? Any thoughts?
It's interesting because there's always so many different angles to take in terms of explaining the basic concepts of the heart doctrine of the zero point teaching, and you can approach it from a lot of different ways. Just the idea, I guess, is that it's kind of difficult to grasp this all at once, and you have to kind of listen to it and try to mull it over and try to incorporate certain ideas and see certain connections, because I don't think it's contrary to what most educated people are taught to believe and about a variety of topics, and it requires a certain amount of dropping of assumptions and a certain amount of unlearning to kind of grasp the radically different conceptualization of consciousness that's being put forward, and radically different concept of the nature of reality in essence, because you're talking not only about the material physical world but also about metaphysics and higher dimensions, and most people, you know, that's not really in their vocabulary, and even for physicists, that they have their own special way of thinking about these things.
But they're
such profound ideas when you start to be able to relate them to things that people can observe in themselves. Like I would think that the one comment I do have is I would think that a lot of people would be surprised by your comment that psychologists don't really regard us as having an I. It's having a central eye.
An individual eye? You think they do?
No, I agree with what you're saying. I think people would be surprised that psychologists don't see that.
Because
I think people would think, well, what about the ego? And the idea of the ego, which most people are familiar with. But that's really quite different from what you're talking about.
Well, that's what I'm saying, is this other consciousness system, the false consciousness system of the ego in the mind.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's part, like, this consciousness in the mind, in the head. I'm not disputing that. I'm just saying the deeper level of self is within the heart. Yeah, so it is, yeah. It's, as you say, like, in a way, there's so much in there when I introduce these subjects, and
yeah.
There's such a complexity to it and the language and such.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why I try to always go back and explain it and give it different angles on the teachings and such. It's been fun lately working again at Blavatsky and trying to relate it to the ideas in physics and such.
Yeah.
I thought we might take the last half hour of the show today and maybe we'll come back to that.
Okay.
I don't know if you've ever heard of or met our guest, Jim, today.
I guess I'd have to know who it was before I could.
Oh, okay.
Answer that question.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, he's in the background here, and it's Denny Rancourt, and Denny is a physics professor at the University of Ottawa.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And several years ago, he was asked to teach a course, I think, on like science and society, and that evolved into. A course addressing, I think, a wide range of social and contemporary issues and turned into an activism course. And he introduced innovative aspects of his teaching at the university and had a course open to people from the community to come out and attend. And that's really become, this has generated a lot of student interest in there. And this is, it seems like exactly what we imagine should be the basis of university education and waking our students up and educating them. And it seems to be receiving a very favorable response. And then Dr. Rancourt has run into so many kind of obstructions and so on and so forth from the university trying to block and stop his course and so on and so forth. And then I guess being an activism teacher, he's put his actions where are congruent with his thoughts, and so he's taken this as a perfect place for activism. And it seems a central issue here is academic freedom and responsibility of academics in our community. So Dr. Rancourt is also has expertise on the environmental issues. I hope we can get into that today and other areas of his interest in activism. Welcome. Is it Denny or Dennis?
Denny,
that's what I assumed, yeah.
Yeah, thanks. It's a pleasure to be here, Christopher, and it's nice to meet you as well, James.
Yeah, thank you.
Maybe would you like to say something first about the background of what's happening at the moment at the University of Ottawa where
I was listening in on the show just now, and I've looked at the Zero Point website, and I have some thoughts about that. If you would like me to start that way.
Oh, that would be fine.
Okay, because I'm a physicist, and physics is a human construction. It's something that physicists, people have developed together. It's a human thing. It uses mathematics to a great extent, and people try to understand the world using the tools of mathematics and developing conceptual models and seeing to what degree they apply to reality and so on. So it's a construct that I'm very familiar with because I've been a physicist for a long time. And I have a very hard time seeing how physics could connect with the kinds of zero-point ideas that you discuss. I find that when you make the relationship between the zero-point theory from historical readings and what you call higher-dimensional physics of the heart, for example, I just don't see what that's about, and I can't see how physics could help you in that realm. As a physicist, I'm saying this as a physicist. So I find it very tenuous the way that you try to make that connection.
Okay.
Ideas and physics. So I just wanted the world to know out there that I don't agree with that way of using physics or attempting to use physics. before we start. I wanted to give my opinion on that, if that's okay.
Yeah, no, please. Please, thanks for just stating that. And I mean, it would be interesting to have time to go into the issues of the physics and the metaphysics. So I had the opportunity to explain to you some of what I see the parallels as being and such. I mean, just before we move on, like, just as an example...
That wasn't the theme of the show, I know, but I needed to say that because, I'm very uncomfortable with the idea of trying to use physics in that way. I don't think one needs physics to talk about these things, and I don't think that physics is useful in talking about our understanding of self.
But
that's a different topic, isn't it?
It is. It's very interesting. I mean, consider, though, a human being is a quantum system, is it not?
Well, I don't even know what that means, because I know
what a quantum system is in physics.
A quantum system in physics doesn't simply mean that you can count it as a unity. That's not what it means. It means much more than that. So the human being is certainly not a quantum system that you would study in quantum physics, for example. Certainly not.
No, but we are quantum systems. We're composed of material and energetic processes existing within space-time complex.
Well,
so, I mean, we are a quantum system.
No. There are many things that are composed of matter and have interactions that involve energy that are not quantum systems. From a physicist perspective, the term as a physicist would use it, right? In order to be... Only very small objects can be quantum systems in the world of physics. If we're going to use physics as it is used by physicists, one cannot say that a human being is a quantum system. I could go into the reasons for that, but it's not the topic of today's show, right?
No, it would be. It would take us off. It would take us off, because I would really dispute that, and I would say that's the kind of links we need to be making. But that's aside, and you know, I'm more interested, really, maybe we want to get back to, maybe you would share with us a little bit about the history of your course at U of O and where it's standing now.
I'd like to do that. It connects to the question of self, in a way, because the starting point of the course and the type of pedagogy that I try to do is this idea that we are defined predominantly in an important way by our connections to others. So instead of looking for a self inside of ourselves, I believe that an important part of us arises from our connections with others, in other words, from society, from societal and cultural texture. And
from outside of ourselves.
Yeah, outside of ourselves. So in connection with others, in interaction with others, that defines ourselves to a large extent. And if you believe that, then you immediately start to be very concerned with questions of social justice. And you become, you feel compassion, and you feel ill at how people in our own country, in our own immediate environment, but also in other parts of the world, are being treated, are being oppressed and abused and you know, raped and killed and displaced and the whole bit on the scale of entire continents. You become very, very concerned with that general question of social justice and with the moral degradation that it represents, that it brings up, you know, onto us. So I think that's one of the main diseases, a modern disease that we suffer from, that hurts the individual in our advanced society because we are connected in this way. So that's how I see the self, more in terms of those connections. And so I'm very concerned with questions of social justice. And I've come to believe through my readings and my study that the way to address, the way to generate social justice and to fight injustice is through action, through activism, through trying to impose one's sense of justice as much as you can through influence, trying to play a role in constructing society and moving things towards a more just, more democratic world where people actually have control over the economy and over important economic decisions and so on, where it's not just an elite that is running things and that is insulated from the majority of people. So these are the things I'm concerned with, and that's what activism is about. And I believe that the justice that we have in Canada, for example, in North America, has largely arisen from activism. You know, the civil rights movements, the women's movements, the fighting racial problems and so on, has always come from confronting the status quo and confronting the elite power that attempt to atomize us, to separate us in order to be able to control us and to pit us one group against another, and to control our mental environment through the media, through Hollywood, through all of these mass media methods, so that we can be perfect consumers and perfectly ignorant of how our corporations and our governments are exploiting others, you see. So,
yes, so
these
really
are the problems as I see them.
It's like a mass hypnosis of humankind that's been so enculturated by through the media and the educational system, how really your type of information and teaching, how readily is that available within our universities?
Well, it's not. I mean, the institution, the university institution, serves power and is tied to power. So it avoids education. And it's more about making obedient employees.
Yeah.
That's clear if you look at how the institution functions, what it actually does, not what it says, not what its mission statement is, but what it actually does.
Yeah.
It's clear that it's simply an instrument of power.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I guess a lot of the financial and the backing of the university is all tied into that same kind of substructure.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
The elite that runs the university is the same elite, you know, through the Board of Governors, connections with the upper executive and so on. They're all in the same family. They're in an elite class that is the corporate class, that
mm-hmm.
is the financial class, and so on. That's clear. The institution is the opposite of a democratic institution. There is no democratic power within an institution. All the committees are purely for consultation. All the important decisions are made by the executive that is self-appointed, period.
Wow.
That's how the institution runs.
Wow.
Despite what it claims and despite the appearances it attempts to give, if you look at the detailed structuring and working of it, that's precisely how it works.
So all the ideals that really lies in some sense, it's all in a way we're training people.
Oh, it's lies. There's no other way
to
call it. I mean, the mission statement, the media appearances, the website, the marketing efforts, it's all lies. There's no other way to say it.
And the ideals of kind of having, like, you know, offering the students what they want to most kind of awaken them and educate them, and that's given.
That's the thing. The students actually pay for the majority of the operating costs. Directly in terms of tuition fees. They're adults, yet they have no say in what the programs are like, what the classes are going to be like, what the pedagogical methods are going to be. They virtually have no say in these things, which is quite a unique and remarkable situation in our society, where you have adults paying directly for a service, and the rest of the money predominantly comes from the public, from taxes, and yet these adults and the immediate community into which the campus is centered have virtually no say in how the programs are designed and what they're used for. So they're basically victims of a corporate training camp, and they must go through it. That's what it is.
Yeah.
You can have a nice life as a student on a university campus despite the system. You know, there are accidents, and you can find courses and professors that you will enjoy, and colleagues, co-students that you will have great discussions with, and so on. But the institution itself, that's not the purpose. Okay, that's been my observation over the years.
I guess most recent issues, they they have actually stopped your course at the moment, like having allowing you to offer it in French and English, or English, or
they've removed me from this year. Start so for the next academic year that will start in the fall, they've removed me from all the freshman undergraduate courses that I have developed, all of them.
Yeah,
and they've given me only upper level graduate courses with very few students in them.
Keep you away from
very technical courses, you know, and they've removed me from this course in particular, the activism course, the science and society course, is one that the students and I fought for and obtained over, you know, an 11-month period. It took 11 months to get it created and approved. It had to go through 16 committees. It was a very tedious process, and they put up every barrier they could. But through activism, the students succeeded in pushing this course through, and it was given only once before they decided it's simply too dangerous and they cannot have it.
Yeah.
So they've removed it from my workload for the coming fall, and they will not attribute classrooms to it. They're simply not putting it on the books as accredited course.
Wow.
Which is a pretty big move on their part. It's a very bold move because, you know, students, especially activist students, are not pleased about this. And so the students have formed a freedom of expression committee in order to fight for the existence of this course and the continuation of it. And maybe your listeners, if they want more information, there is a website of this committee.
Give it.
Okay, well, it's called Freedom of Express, in one word, freedomofexpress.tripod.com. So it's a tripod website. freedomofexpress.tripod.com. And on that website, the students have put together a link to a petition. So there's an online petition. If your listeners want to read the background material, read the petition statement, and go to that petition link, they can sign it and make comments. And the petition is to have the president, the vice president academic, and the dean of the Faculty of Science resign from their positions, given what they've done.
Wow. Wow, what a bold step that's what should be done, really.
Yeah.
I mean, they've
violated academic freedom. They've broken all the rules, and so I've also initiated a legal action. I have a legal grievance for $10 million in reparation due to the defamation and the dirty tricks, the sustained harassment, you name it. So that is moving forward as well. And if there's any monetary payment that is given, if it's awarded, I will use it. I will use it to develop freedom of expression on campus. I will use the money to help independent student groups develop and run their actions and so on.
Wow.
That's the idea.
Wow, you've most directly challenged them. That's so excellent. Wow.
Well, I think that's what you have to do. And when you do challenge directly in this way, when you use activism to try and change society or an institution, that is when you learn what that institution is really like.
Hmm.
Yeah,
I don't believe you can know by reading their mission statement or their website what they're really like. You have to challenge them. And then you get a reaction, you get a backlash, and that informs you as to their true nature.
Yeah, you have to try to change a system to understand what it is.
Yes. I believe you have to interact. You can't sit in a room and think about what's that system like, given the evidence I'm receiving. You actually have to go in and interact with it.
Yeah,
and then
because much is normally everything is secret and hidden. And
absolutely.
People kind of go about their life and they never think to ask or... It's not raised as an
it's
issue.
It's absolutely hidden. You're right about that. It's all about conspiracy. It's all about higher executives not putting anything down on paper, having committee meetings, understandings, expressing biases, expressing preferences, understanding through, this kind of pecking order type of, system. And it's all about that. So it's very much run that way. It's that kind of a very closed institution. So you can't really know what the culture of the institution is like until you do this.
I mean, that's one finger of this massive kind of conspiracy group that runs the, I mean, that's a symptom of this massive problem throughout our society and the world society. It seems, I guess, activism like start at home, like in a way this is it like reminds me of the idea of the beating of the butterfly wings. You know, you just start where you are and beat your wings there, and like this, it creates a bigger issue because it forces people to look at what's underlying this and then what's being taught and why aren't we being taught and who owns the university and where's this freedom of expression and so on. It raises so much more and how it could magnify the impulse of your initial course.
Well, I think you're right about that. I think that where we can have the most impact is in our immediate surroundings.
Yeah.
Because you're part of those surroundings. And if you start to resist or to confront or to ask for explanations, that's going to reverberate much more than if you have some theoretical discussion about the problems in the third world or something like that, you know. And if we build democracy here and if we build fair institutions and we develop a culture where we think in terms of democracy and fairness, that will necessarily help others, because the first world will take charge of its society, of its corporations and so on, and so we don't want our corporations and our financial institutions to exploit others.
And doing so what? Sorry, going to others?
We don't want our financial institutions and corporations to be exploiting others.
Yeah, I mean, that's so basic to their structure, and it has been so long, people haven't realized what's been done. And the whole structure of society, the financial system and the banking system and the corporate world and these elites, and how, I mean, imagine how they've gained such control over the mass media like that. It's really quite horrifying.
It's all about stealing. It's organized robbery.
Yeah.
That's what it is. I mean, there's a net flow of resources from the third world to the first world. If you count all the so-called aid, which often is just building public money used to build infrastructure so that corporations can better exploit the third world, right? Like airports and roads so they can ship out the goods and the cash crops and so on. Even if you count all that aid going towards the third world, if you look at the net flow, there's a huge net flow of resources and riches from the third world to the first world. It's organized robbery is what it is.
Yeah.
If we want to help them, the way to do it is not to give them aid, it's to stop robbing them.
Yeah.
Because the net flow is in that direction, if you simply stop having contact with them, they'll be better off.
Yeah.
Because
wow.
You won't be pulling out these resources, you see.
Yeah.
They'll be able to use the land to grow their own food. They'll be able to take what they need from the ocean on their coast and so on, instead of just trying to pay back these artificial debts, these financial debts that we've burdened them with through absolutely criminal mechanisms. I mean,
like that recent book on what was Confessions of a
Economic Hitman.
Economic Hitman?
Yeah, yeah. John Perkins.
Right.
You must be familiar with that, how the banks loaned the monies at very high rates, and then the cash flow's not enough. They just sink deeper and deeper into debt, and so the corporations and the financial institutions just suck all that money out of the third world countries, as you
say. Well, of course. I mean, they don't negotiate fair rates of interest because it's a very asymmetric power relationship.
Yeah.
So basically, you're stuck and you need help. You're going to borrow money, and you're going to borrow it at the interest rate that is imposed because you don't have a choice.
Kind of like credit card companies with individuals.
Exactly. I mean, not so long ago, interest itself was considered immoral, right? It was called usury, and most great religions forbade it.
Yeah, it's condemned in the Bible, in the Ezekiel, and the law about usury.
Why should one make money just because you're lending the resources that you illegitimately control? You happen to have a concentration of wealth, and you're going to make money because you're going to give access to people to a livelihood through giving them access to those resources. You want to be able to make money from that? How is that just? How is that moral? you know?
I mean, there's just incredible social injustice in our world. I mean, we have these masters of war who you know, make billions off human suffering and exploitation and cruelty. I mean, it's inconceivable what's happened. You know. And all the wars are just, they're our own imperialism. We, you know, as Western society, have become the aggressors and invaded the Eastern land, Mideast now, and the states have done it through history. They've invaded any other countries that oppose their influence and control.
Could I make a comment about this, Chris?
Yeah, please.
Listening to Denis talk about his course, I sort of flashed back to many years ago when I was studying the student movement in the 60s, and it's funny because it's kind of come full circle, you know, that in the early 60s, the student radicals in North America, one of the main disputes they had with the university that started on the university itself was the paternalism of the university and was the absolute lack of control that students had over their own lives and that what they'd study and sort of the objection to the fact that basically universities are corporate factories to turn out, you know, turn out products to fit into the corporate world. And so I guess the question I have for our guest is, why do you think they're so threatened by what you teach?
Oh, well, I teach that students should be in control of their lives and of the curriculum. And I give students control within my class. And so that is directly threatening to the hierarchy and the power structure. Because instead of creating the employees that they want, and instead of isolating them through disciplinal boundaries, you know, you will be just a physicist or just a chemist, and therefore you won't think about the politics of what you're doing or the moral implications or anything else. If you break that down and you say, no, you will think, you will be a full person, you will follow your interests, you will learn what you are motivated to learn, and you will be discussing it with your colleagues and so on, and you're just going to learn through the true natural process of learning. And you will not be graded or evaluated. I will not use a carrot and stick approach, which is called grades. You automatically have the maximum mark because you're here and because you're trying to learn. That's all there is to it. It's breaking down the control that the institution has on the system and therefore on the individual. And so that is directly threatening to that institution. Do you see what I'm saying?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's an excellent answer, too. They should be threatened by you.
Oh, yes. The fact that they are threatening and the fact that they have reacted so strongly is an indication that we're doing the right thing.
Yeah.
It's evidence that we're clearly doing the right thing.
Yeah. Any of this sound familiar, Chris?
It's funny hearing about this case and how I didn't deal with my case at York back, you know, in 84. I was denied tenure there. And yeah, it reminds me of the similar problems. I certainly see everything that ever happened to me in a totally different light since waking up to realize the kind of elite substructure of our society. I had no concept of that at the time. I had no idea of the matrix I was in.
Yeah.
I see, you know, sometimes I think, you know, that maybe we're on the edge of World War III. We almost could be because we're heading so much into escalation of Mideastern war and
the escalation
of the kind of police state mentality in the States. And then on the other hand, I think the other Third World War is the information war. And that kind of, it strikes me, Denny, that's what, like, this is about. This is the information war, waking people up, letting them be informed of what's happening.
But, you know, North America is special because North America, well, is the center of the U.S. empire. And so that's where people, the population, need to be the most ignorant. They need their mental environment needs to be controlled more than anywhere else if the empire is not going to be challenged from within. And so the mind control system in the U.S. has been developed to a very, very high degree with, you know, with the entertainment industry and the media is completely controlled, et cetera, et cetera. That's necessary. And so it, people are much more out of reality and disconnected from reality in the United States than anywhere else in the world. I mean, in the third world, they know they're being oppressed. They know they know who the oppressor is as well, right? It's very, very clear to them. You don't have to explain it to them. But in the United States and Canada, you clearly have to sit down with people and step by step explain that we are in an isolated world, and we're part of a system that exploits the rest of the world by these mechanisms that I will now spell out to you. I know you've never seen them or experienced them except through the unfairness in your workplace and indirect things like that, which are related, of course, but you haven't seen, you know, the butt of a machine gun in your face or these kinds of things that people in the third world routinely see. The so-called war on drugs that sprays Agent Orange into huge parts of the Amazon forest and kills the people by destroying their gardens and their livelihood and drives them from the forest so that they can do the mineral exploitation, et cetera, et cetera. You know, this is all routine in the third world. I mean, there is huge dislike, I could almost use the word hatred, of the United States imperialistic system. In the third world, because people recognize that that the U.S. is one of the main components of the oppressive system. And its military is obvious. It's everywhere. There are hundreds and hundreds of military bases all over the world.
I know. It's terrible.
Well, we could go on for hours about that.
It's so huge. I mean, your course kind of would offer students things about all these problems, all aspects of society. You bring in a wide range of speakers and aides, and do you not, Denny?
Yes, and we try to break that information barrier. We try to break those myths and those illusions.
Yeah.
And we do it by bringing in people who actually have lived these injustices as much as we can. For example, we had a woman member of parliament from Afghanistan by the name of Malala Joya.
Oh, you did? Oh.
Yes, we did. She opened the course last fall with the first lecture. There was over 500 people in the largest auditorium in campus, and she came directly from Afghanistan to open the course and gave a talk that just shook the city. I mean, it was just unbelievable.
Yeah.
And this woman is a human rights activist in her own country, and she was elected by chance to the parliament despite the U.S. wanting to control everyone who was elected and putting their warlord puppets in place.
Yeah.
She succeeded in getting in despite that because she's got huge popular support.
I mean, she named the drug lords during that.
That's right.
She's
pointing out that this parliament is not legitimate, and at the risk of her life. There have been many, many attempts on her life. And just recently, a couple of weeks ago, she was ejected from parliament. The parliamentarians tried to use an illegitimate legal process to eject her from parliament. So she's in a very difficult situation right now. If you Google Malala Joya, you can find out about it and help the support committee that is trying to get her back into the parliament.
Wow, what a brave woman.
Yeah.
I saw her speech at the New Democratic Party.
That's right. Well, at that same time, just after she was at the New Democratic Party convention in Montreal, she came to Ottawa for the activism course, you see, in that same week. So those are the kinds of people we try to bring in. So when people are exposed to that kind of truth and to that kind of deep commitment to justice, it moves you, and you develop compassion for co-inhabitants of the planet.
And I mean, we all need to be morally outraged by what's been done in our name and with how we as a society has been robbed. from within. Like, they've robbed us blind in a way and done these horrendous things in our name.
I mean,
people could grasp it and realize that.
Yeah, I think one of the main things I try to achieve in the activism course is, because a lot of the students are new to even the idea of activism, or new to the problems of the world, and one of the first things I try to achieve is to instill a kind of moral outrage. I try to expose students to enough different outrageous cases,
mm-hmm.
case by case, speaker by speaker, documentary film by documentary film, that they start to get a sense of the horrible things that are happening, and one or another of these issues will touch different individuals deeply, and that's the first step to becoming a committed social justice activist.
Yeah. I think Denis really struck on something. I just wanted to mention something that he brought up earlier, and it's that part of the reason why there isn't the moral outrage in North America is that we are so profoundly ignorant of what's done in our name overseas, and Americans, Canadians, Western Europeans, in terms of exploiting the third world. And really, you know, when people talk about political correctness, the real political correctness doesn't have anything to do with, you know, not using certain words. The real political correctness is that our government is essentially benevolent, and that our system, the capitalistic system, is essentially this benevolent system that operates overseas, and we don't see it, but that we're not doing any harm. But that's just completely false. And on the topic of Afghanistan, I guess I had read some material on Afghanistan, but I've been reading the War on Freedom by Nafiz Ahmed, and he talks about what's happened in Afghanistan since the Soviet invasion in 1979. And Canadians and Americans, every country whose troops are involved in Afghanistan should try to inform themselves about what's going on over there. These people have been just royally screwed and exploited and damaged in a way that's so incomprehensible that we should all be ashamed of ourselves. We should be ashamed of our ignorance. We should be ashamed of our government. We should be ashamed of our military presence there. It's just absolutely disgusting.
Yeah.
I couldn't agree with you more. It's a criminal war. It's disgusting. We're interfering and trying to put, the U.S. and Canada are trying to put their puppets into power.
Yep.
And in directly interfering by social engineering, which means killing people, to make sure that the people they don't want there don't get into power. It's completely...
And the whole thing founded on the lie of 9/11.
Absolutely.
You know, absolutely. Like, that, they staged it. Like, people can't grasp it. Like, they can't conceive it. But the evidence is absolutely overwhelming. I'm on the internet a lot. There's such overwhelming evidence. You know, there is no social justice. Like, you mentioned, Denny, social justice. Like, horrendous. There is no social justice. In a way, we have these criminal psychopaths who just... it's unspeakable, the things that are being done, and this deception, mass deception of the American public.
I agree.
Canadian
and so once
public.
You become outraged, once you start to see that, and I think you can only see it when you confront a system and suffer the backlash. I mean, students learn that in my course. I really enjoy seeing it. Every year I meet students who go through that transition, you know, where at first they believe, well, if we just ask the president, I'm sure he would, you know, we could sit down rationally and discuss it with him, and they'd agree, and they'd let us do this, and so on. So they start with those assumptions that the system is benevolent. And I say, well, go ahead, ask. I think you have good arguments and so on. And eventually, they realize, you know, at first they get co-opted, or they're given false arguments, or the whole thing. But eventually, they realize that they're just not getting what they want, and
yeah.
that they're not going to get it, and that there's real resistance to it.
Yeah,
and
just
so then they press a little harder, and then they get a real backlash, and then they realize for the first time that the institution is not about to give them what they would like.
Yeah.
So it's a real wake-up.
They're not there to serve the student interest.
That's right.
They're there to maintain their positions and the power as is, the power structure.
But you can't really understand that until you've come up against it. And especially if you've been indoctrinated to believe that it's a benevolent institution. But then when you have that phase transition, and I love seeing it, the students will come to me and they'll say, okay, now I get it. I understand what's going on.
With the phase transition?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's a phase transition in their in their worldview, if you know what I mean. And they'll say things like, I get it. Okay, now I won't be duped like this again. And now I'm going to use effective methods to get what we need to ensure justice. And they become activists. I've written about this. I've written about these transitions. I've written about activism. Maybe I could give the URL of the blog where I've
Yeah, please do.
I've posted some of these writings at a blog that is called Activist Teacher. One word with two T's in the middle. activistteacher.blogspot.com.
Blogspot.com.
So it's the blogger system. So activistteacher.blogspot.com.
Blogspot. So.
Yeah, that's one word. And
okay,
.com. And my writings on environmental issues and the whole debate related to global warming, I have posted at a different blog called Climate Guy, one word, climateguy.blogspot.com. And so that's where I put some of my links and writings and so on, because I've learned a lot from being involved on campus this way, and so I try to communicate that to other teachers and to activists through these writings and links and comments and so on.
Do you get much support within your academic community, like other professors who are sympathetic and kind of see what the dynamic is?
There are, it's not an exaggeration to say there are virtually no activist professors around. I mean, I know of only a few in North America.
Yeah, that process of socialization is pretty pretty powerful.
Oh, yes. I mean, the tenure granting process is an incredible, it's two things. It's a filter, but it's also a way of co-opting people, because if you're trying to get tenure for 10 or 15 or more years, and the whole time you're behaving in such a way that you'll eventually be granted this tenure, then you're going to transform yourself to the point where you will never confront the system.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a very powerful system, and it's been written about in a wonderful book. There's a wonderful analysis of professional schools and educational institutions and so on, written by one of the speakers in the activism course, in fact, Jeff Schmidt. Dr. Jeff Schmidt wrote a book called Disciplined Minds.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a Disciplined Minds website as well, if you Google Disciplined Minds. It's a brilliant book, a little-known book that has really inspired me. In fact, if I had to name one book that inspired me to start doing activism courses, it would be that book.
Yeah, I was going to ask a similar question to Chris in terms of the don't you, as a physicist, I mean, a physicist and activism, aren't you guys supposed to be off looking at quarks or something? I mean, I'll bet your colleagues really lap that up.
My colleagues are in the Faculty of Science, and in the Department of Physics also, are vehemently opposed to the things that I'm doing.
they are. Oh.
But, you know, on the topic of physicists, 80% of physicists, roughly, in North America work for the military in one way or another.
Yeah.
80%. Wow. So, I mean, it's not about quarks. Or if it is about quarks, it's because there are military spin-offs. And I've written about that as well. I wrote a piece entitled, Are Physicists Smart? It's on the globalresearch.ca website. And it's linked to through my blogs.
I guess that you would have probably a different perspective on the claim that science is value free.
Oh yeah, very different perspective.
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, science, you know, as we practice it in our society, and given how it's funded and controlled, and given how professional scientists are trained, science is completely political.
Yeah.
Completely at service of power.
Yeah.
It serves power. There's no doubt about it. That's what science is about. And these expert scientists who are used by the media and who are used by governments serve that purpose, to keep people away from their own education and their own development and their own thoughts and their own analysis, so that you're pushed towards these so-called experts. You're not supposed to really understand what they do, but trust that they're doing something for the public good. You know, have this blind trust in these experts. I mean, that's what it's all about. And I argue that people need to educate themselves, and I argue that the way to educate yourself is not necessarily just to sit down with a book, but to act, as we were saying earlier. You're only going to find out what the world is like by interacting with it. Those things that you learn by this kind of activism and direct action and organizing and so on, you cannot learn any other way. And that those are the things you need to learn to help change the world and transform society. I always push people towards action.
Yeah.
And solidarity and organizing and discussion, you know, those are all related to action.
I mean, there seems, I would say, like a worldwide truth movement at this time, like all through the internet so much. And I mean, we've had this emergence of Ron Paul in the U.S. scene, who I think is quite a remarkable politician. And Do you feel that's happening, Denny, that there is
Did
that...
Did you call it the truth movement?
The truth movement coming out through the States, and like people realize...
Is that related to 9/11? I'm not...
Well, the 9/11, but also the elites and what's happening in terms of the movement towards a police state and the corruption of the pharmaceutical companies and the chemtrails and the...
Right.
All the kind of weather changing, all these things that the mind control techniques they've
I would suggest to people, and it comes back to what we were just saying, it's one thing to read, websites on the net, try and get information that way and so on, but you're not really going to connect with reality till you go out into your workplace, into your school, into your church organization, into whatever it is that you participate in. And ask yourself, what is that institution about, and why is it run undemocratically? Because these are all undemocratic institutions. You know, why should the boss at work have all this power over employees? It's not a democratic division of labor. Employees don't have a say in the decisions of the company. Why should that be the case? It's intrinsically unfair. It's undemocratic. And so... you can challenge that. You don't necessarily challenge it directly in such a way as to immediately get fired, but there are ways to oppose that unfairness. And these methods are described to a large extent in the book Disciplined Minds. But when you start to be an activist, it doesn't mean just a weekend thing. It means creating democracy in the real things that you do in your life.
Yeah, wow.
And I think that will give one perspective on the theories and thoughts and analyses that one can then read on the web, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think there's another side to it. I mean, I think it's really valuable to grasp a bit of the larger picture of it all. In a way, I think we need. I feel we're at such precarious times at this point in human history, like over the next years. I don't know, I mean I see the 9/11 event, I mean that is huge, because in a way that provided the evidences for some kind of massive, we've been conned, like Western society, we've been conned.
Right.
And once people, if they wake up and can grasp that, and then we've been conned, and then you look at the media, and the media's conned us too.
yes.
You know, that kind of shock. Gurdjieff, a mystic, calls them shocks, like something that shocks people out of their complacency.
Whatever works, and different things work for different people.
Yeah.
That's right. But you need to be shocked, and you need to, we were talking about outrage earlier.
Yeah,
but
outrage.
Whatever works.
Yeah, leads to outrage, kind of, yeah.
If someone becomes an activist through learning about 9/11 and all of the inconsistencies and lies related to that, great. But the main thing is we need more activists.
Yeah.
However they're made.
And you have members of the Freedom of Expression group. They send out a kind of an activism newsletter of events on that your members of your group are involved in Ottawa.
That's right.
You seem to have weekly meetings outside the Israeli embassy, to try to stop the war in Iran.
That's a separate thing. I think there's a few activists who are involved.
I guess what they've done. I mean, it's not all your efforts, but students who.
Oh yeah, these
students, these other activities, kind of.
Yes, the students who are involved in the Freedom of Expression Committee are activists for the most part, and therefore have a broad variety of things that they're involved with, the anti-war effort and the mind control of the media, opposing that, et cetera, et cetera. You know, they're involved in dozens and dozens of things. Once you become an activist, you try and help out with all the things that you can, and you try and see. And also there are occasions where you have to put a push on. For example, when Bush visits Ottawa, it's an occasion to have an impact on how Canadians see that visit and how they interpret it. And so there's organization around that for a while, et cetera. You know, it just depends on the circumstances. But that's right. These students are involved in many programs like that.
Yeah.
That's right.
I would like to hear some of your commentary on the carbon emissions, the gas taxes. I gather that you're skeptical or you think there's been a misinterpretation of some of the data, and I would like to hear, Denny, some of your perspective on those
on
issues.
The global warming?
Yeah.
Okay. I could try and summarize it this way. I mean, I've written a large article about it called Global Warming, Truth or Dare, which is on the Climate Guy .blogspot.com site, so people can find it there. They can find a link to it. What I say is that basically this is going to come as a shock to some environmentalists out there, but what I say is that the global warming thing is largely a red herring that is used by power to divert our attention away from real problems and away from confronting power regarding those real problems, and divert our attention instead towards what the experts would like us to look at, which is a sanitized version of problems that involves the CO2 concentration, the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere, okay, which is something that is, you know, just a purely chemical, sanitized problem that you can debate about and that you can, but it's not clear, you know, environmental degradation where you're going in and clear-cutting forests and changing the water tables and removing people's livelihoods on the scale of entire regions and so on. You know, there are so many horrible environmental catastrophes on the planet.
Yeah, and ongoing.
Ongoing that have virtually nothing to do with CO2 and fossil fuel burning. You know, they have to do with cash crops and how agriculture is exploited to pay back illegitimate debts, financial debts that we were talking about, et cetera. Those are the real transformations of the planet, and they are directly caused by a world financial and corporate exploitation system. And that is what needs to be challenged if we are going to, save the environment. Not to mention saving all the people that we're destroying their livelihood, their cultures, their lives. What I argue is that the global warming thing is largely a myth, and it's a fabrication to turn our attention away from it. I mean, we love to argue about these scientific questions that cannot really be answered, you know, and have experts oppose each other and debate these things, and just keep it all at the level of the CO2 and so on. Now, I'm an environmental scientist, so I've criticized the science, but from as a scientist, and so we don't have enough time for me to go into those details. But what I argue is that, for example, you cannot measure the average surface temperature on the planet with enough reliability to be able to say that it's increasing. I don't even believe that, and I'm not the only one. There are world-class statisticians who have explained that average is ill-defined, that you cannot calculate it. Mm-hmm. The only thing we're sure of is that the CO2 concentration in the atmosphere is increasing. That's clear. You know, that can be measured unambiguously. But most of the other extrapolations from that and what it's doing and so on are completely tenuous. I mean, for example, I believe that it's more likely that CO2 is increasing because the radiation balance on the planet is changing.
Because, the sun being hotter.
In other words, it's a response rather than a cause.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that the causal relationship, there's a strong correlation in a lot of paleo climate data between CO2 and temperature that can be extrapolated from oxygen isotopes, let's say. And people have said, well, that correlation must be, there must be a causal link there. See, I don't believe that at all, and a lot of scientists don't believe that. In fact, there is no consensus in the science. If you look at the IPCC reports, the International Panel on Climate Change reports, you typically have 75 pages of, let's say, what they call consensus, and then 140 pages of footnotes where all the scientists qualify that they don't agree with this or that for these reasons and so on. And then you have the executive summary of that, which in the end gets transformed politically, and then scientists are complaining that were on the committee are complaining that that's not what they had said, and why did you change it at the last minute for political reasons, et cetera. And there's all this debate going on. It's been exposed. I mean, it's a political process. It's a red herring.
Yeah.
It's a horrible thing that I've written about, that others have written about. And I think climateguy.blogspot.com is a really good source to start unraveling all of that.
Yeah. Well, I certainly see your main point is that, in a way, that's such a secondary issue, and it's complicated the aspects of the science. I mean, even if global warming's occurring, there can be other reasons for it as well. It's not just
well, there are regional climate changes, and glaciers are melting, for example.
Yeah.
But you see, I explained that glaciers are melting for other reasons than the average global temperature increasing. They're melting because of what is called radiation balance effects. So there are many, many mechanisms for this, but it's related more to clear-cutting, exposing lands that were forest-covered before, the particulate pollution in the atmosphere due to all kinds of things, due to mineral exploitation, you name it, you know.
So really, to save the planet, we need to deal with the larger corporate structure of the whole.
Well, yeah. My argument is if you create social justice, if you work towards social justice, automatically people, when they control their own environment, and they control their own livelihood and so on, they take care of their environment. They don't exploit it, rip it off to pay a debt off. They don't do that. So, for example, if you want to save the planet, cancel all third world debts. That would be a really good start.
Yeah.
So, the way to help people is to stop robbing them. That's the way to help them. not to stop burning fossil fuels so that their lands won't be flooded. That's ridiculous. You know, when they start arguing that, I mean, if they cared about these people who are more vulnerable according to these models that are completely not reliable, then they would help those people. And the first thing to do is to stop ripping them off.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So, I mean, it's completely disingenuous to have these discourses in the first world about why we're worried about global warming as though, I mean, the evidence is clear that the first world as a system does not care about the third world people. So, I mean, to say that that's why we need to control the Earth's climate system is completely disingenuous. So, those are some of my ideas. But the science has been discussed
in
detail on my
blog. I have a question for Denny about what you're talking about, the impossibility of measuring temperature on the planet. Is that what you were saying? That
yes,
surface
yes. You can measure temperature locally.
Yes,
but
many years ago, I read an article, this was at least 10 years ago, and it was about global warming.
Mm-hmm.
And it said that in trying to model temperature on the planet, that the big unknown was water vapor, that nobody really understood what the effects of water vapor would be in terms of these models. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. I mean, the water cycle is extremely complex. Water vapor is by far the dominant greenhouse gas in the atmosphere.
Right.
CO2 is a trace gas, whereas water vapor is a significant component, and it is a stronger greenhouse gas effect molecule, H2O. So, yeah, the water cycle is the main thing that will that has potential to change radiation balance and warming and so on. That's clear, you know. I mean, ice ages are when the water freezes up on the continent. You know, I mean, that's the main thing. And these models, these climate models, are completely unable to deal with that complexity. In fact, they mask it over and use these ad hoc feedback factors, and just therefore they predict what they build into the model, as opposed to actually modeling anything realistic.
So that would be related to all sorts of things, from deforestation to agribusiness.
Oh yeah, none of this is included in the model.
Yeah,
I mean, the models are just completely overly simple, even though they're complex.
Yeah.
Compared to reality, they're humongous simplifications, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I mean, and they're constructed in such a way to give you the answer that they want to see, and then they believe them. I mean, scientists, you know, fool themselves. Often and easily. I mean, I see it all the time in my research. Dominant paradigms that scientists believe, and it takes a while for them to shake them off.
Yeah, like the benevolence of the system.
For example.
Yeah. I did want to ask, like, you're an environmental scientist. I'm very concerned about the chemtrails and materials I've come across saying all the everything from viruses and heavy metals and aluminum fibers. I watch chemtrails now in Ottawa. I take pictures of them sometimes. And you just see the big, huge streams going this way and that way. And you can see them come down, and they make the kind of the particular types of clouds. And what is this all about? And like, how? I just can't grasp the what this program is, and how does something like that tie into environment if you're putting all this aluminum flake into the atmosphere?
Right.
Like, it's somewhat concerned
well,
about
particulate matter in the atmosphere does change radiation balance, and that's known to be, you know, one of the main players when you're worried about radiation balance, which in turn
so chemtrail spraying could be influencing the temperatures.
I'd have to look into it, but it has potential for that. But you know, the main particulate matter loading effects on the scale of the planet are natural. Well, let me explain. Natural in quotations, in the sense
like
that
volcanoes and
well, if you have clear cutting and if you have cash crops and if you have agriculture, where you're depleting the soil, and there are periods when you've got a lot of dry soil where before you had grasslands or forests, then the wind will pick up a lot of mineral dust, and that mineral dust is a huge component of particulate matter in the atmosphere. So forest fires is another source. If you have huge forest fires...
But are you familiar with the chemtrails?
I'm not. I have not looked...
Wow, that is such a disturbing phenomena.
Yeah.
You see it in the States. If you're on the web and you can see...
Is it based on satellite photos?
Sorry?
Is it based on satellite photos?
No, it's people with cameras and such. You can see them up and look out, learn to watch your environment. You can see when they're spraying.
Right.
You know, they do it very high atmosphere. They're huge, huge trails that don't dissipate for a long, long time. And you can
right.
see them come down and form clouds, right. and they settle on us.
Right.
And, I mean, I think the pharmaceutical companies are tied into it. And mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know. I mean... Sometimes I hear Alex Jones would talk about genocide, like these beings, some of them seem so disturbed.
Well, you know, you can worry about a lot of things like that. I mean, you could isolate environmental problems one at a time and go into the chemistry and the physics of them and how they're distributed and all of this. But in the end, it's about social justice, you know?
Well, that is, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, if this is true that we're being poisoned through chemtrails, I mean, it seems a little serious.
I mean, well, I worry more about the quality of our food.
Yeah.
You know?
And with all these genetically modified Some grains now, which have been genetically modified, are
sure, and
to cause
a lot
cancer
of nutrients and vitamins in the food as well, because you're not growing things on rich soil anymore. It's not organic soil; it's chemical fertilizers, and so you know the raspberries taste just like the tomatoes, who taste just like the cardboard, you know.
Yeah.
And I mean, if you want to know what real food tastes like, you have to go to Europe or France or someplace like that where they still care about that, you know.
Yeah.
Or have your own garden.
It's funny, whenever people talk about the economy, you know, they never talk about topsoil or water or air, you know. It's Sir Albert Howard, who was a great British agriculturalist, said that the wealth of a nation is directly proportional to the quality of its topsoil.
Mm.
You know, and I mean, that's...
Well, I'm not sure how much that's true now.
Well,
I mean,
but the point I think is, you know, it's like, I mean...
In the long run.
Think about that, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, we North America, look at it. We've been, the white guys have been here for a couple of hundred years, and the quality of topsoil has degenerated so dramatically, and the quantity of it, that it's, you know, I mean, we're really on our last legs almost.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be hard to fix that. I mean, you get rid of the mega corporations,
yeah.
Go back to family farms, or and develop a culture where people enjoy having gardens and have the space to have gardens. Have social justice to the point where you don't have people living in extreme poverty in developments in the cities, in the inner cities, and everyone can share plots out in the country, and there's public transportation to get out there, and
movement
all this. There are so many things that could be done that would not be hard to do, and it's not a question of lack of resources. I mean, one statistic that I like to remind people of is the United Nations study in 1999 that showed that the World Health Organization there showed that the money that is spent on pet food in Europe and the United States would have been enough in 1999. To give proper nourishment and sanitation to all the people who need it on the planet, and there would have been a sizable amount left over. So that gives you the mental image that it's not about, you don't have to deprive yourself of very much in order to be just.
It strikes me the wealth of the world has been consumed by things which have been completely unnecessary, like, I mean, if you imagine the U.S. has put $500 billion into the war in the Middle East, I mean, they could have just bought the Arab oil for that, couldn't they? Like, just and that would have supported something.
Of course, there are profits to be made from war.
There's no, but there is profits, but it doesn't produce anything real. It's artificial expense. Like, that's what's happened. I mean, the American economy,
it goes into the print money.
Well, the U.S. economy is a military economy. The whole idea is to make useless things, like missiles and silos and things like that. That's the whole idea. You're using public funds and directly transferring it into private profits.
Yeah, into
that.
That's
military. How it operates. That's how it's run. Those are the influences in the halls of power. That's what it's about. I mean, that's clear.
Yeah.
Noam Chomsky has written about this brilliantly, as usual, in the book Understanding Power is a particularly good one that I really enjoy. It's clear that it's a military economy.
Yeah,
and Canada,
I mean, now they have all these, like, all the billions of dollars of security at Canadian airports, and they take your little scissors, and if you have a lighter, and I mean, it's so ridiculous. Have they ever caught anyone anywhere in Canada after spending billions of dollars on all the security?
Well, there's profits to be made from that as well,
and
it's also part of the mental control, because if you're being tested to that degree, you're going to be convinced that there are dangers, right? And that's what they want to convince you of in order to justify the war efforts and so on. So, I mean, it's all part of the mental control.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was reading something the other day about the European witch craze in the 17th century, and the analysis was a sociological analysis in terms of the Catholic Church had to maintain its power, and the aristocracy had to maintain its power because the peasants and the lower classes were starting to organize and rebel. And so the witch craze basically created, that the church authorized it and ran it, and basically created this terror. And I thought, amongst the population, which divided them. And so they're turning on one another, denouncing one another as witches, and getting caught up in the persecution and the prosecution of witches. And of course, who gets defined as witches are women and the people who have the least amount of power. Meanwhile, you know, any idea of economic reform went right out the window. And I thought, well, gee, that's basically the situation we have with terrorism today.
It's called the War on Terror.
Meanwhile, the biggest shift in the concentration of wealth to fewer and fewer people has been occurring over the last 50 years, and everybody's yelling about how great it is to live in a democracy and be free. I mean, it's all smoke and mirrors to divert people from what's really going on, is that a bunch of a small elite is getting richer and richer and getting more and more power. And that's basically the story. I mean, it's like John Lennon says, you know, like, it keeps you doped with religion and sex and TV, and you think you're so clever and classless and free, but you're still, you know, blankety blank peasants as far as I can see, and that's basically it. You know, I mean, it's to take away, again, it's to take away any sense of outrage. It's to keep people ignorant of what's really going on in their name, and you know, to make them all salute the flag and run around and feel patriotic because we're in a democracy and we're free.
The fear response is very important, and it's
absolutely
used by power. That you know, if people are afraid and react by wanting to protect themselves and react and are willing to give up control to a centralized power that will protect them, in quotations, you know.
Yeah.
So
right.
The fear response is a big deal. And so airport security and alerts of all kinds and all this kind of thing that's pushed in the media, that's all related to keeping people in fear.
Right.
Yeah. And they're wanting implants and all these kind of innovative technologies and terrible things. It's
amazing. Yeah, the modern medicine is another area that we could get into. Were you talking about implants?
Well, implants in the States, even that's been mentioned. I mean, they've used implants illegally and developed it over the years, but that's a future concern. One other thing, just to stay with the environment, and I was very interested also in what your take is on HAARP, and again, like, that seems to be a weather modification program and bouncing. I heard that they bounce such powerful beams off the ionosphere, it heats it up to near the temperature of the sun's corona through some of these particle beams that they're bouncing off the environment, and they explore parts of the...
I haven't looked into it, but, you know, there are all kinds of experiments going on that are funded by the military in hundreds of different areas, you know. But my sense is that there's no way they could affect the planetary, you know, climate system in a significant way by these kinds of modifications. It's just too complex and too big. I mean, the planet is huge, and I mean, they can spend lots of money on these kinds of experiments, and they can try and see what's feasible and what's not. But I don't think it's anywhere near applicability or any kind of significance, you know. That's my sense of it, having not studied it.
Yeah. That's not my sense of it, but...
Yeah.
But I don't know. I'm just trying to inquire. And HAARP was the name of the program.
Right.
And they
right.
have these massive things up in Alaska.
Yeah, I've heard about it, and Michelle Shostakovsky has written about it on globalresearch.ca, but I haven't looked into it myself.
It strikes me how that ties into what you're saying about the way they focused our attention on kind of global warming and driving our cars. It's such a red herring when all there are all these other huge, huge issues which need to be dealt with to deal with the environment. And
absolutely.
Yeah.
And these huge issues are all directly related to corporate and financial power.
Yeah.
But wouldn't you say that is the burning of fossil fuels at the level that we're doing it not a problem?
I don't see any evidence that the burning of fossil fuel that thereby creates CO2, I don't see any evidence that that's a problem in itself.
Well, I mean, there is in terms of like being in cities and smog and
pollution. Oh, sure,
and
sure. The particulate matter, the organic
particulate matter,
the smog, the CO, you know, the heavy metals when you burn coal.
Yeah.
All of this is horrible polluting stuff, and the mining cycle, the miners' health, and they have to transport this material, and all these kinds of things, industrial accidents. Of course, all of that is horrible stuff. But what I mean is just in terms of burning it, and this whole CO2 story about global warming, I don't see that as a problem.
Yeah, as a cause of that.
Yeah.
It's interesting that you have that perspective on it, and that you say that, you know, I mean, for a long time, I mean, it seemed like the oil and gas industry was saying that, oh, scientists don't really agree about global warming, and it seemed to me like there was the usual BS from these guys that they'll do anything to protect their own interests,
sure,
not to do anything.
And that's true. There was a corporate campaign to minimize and subvert any sort of scientific movement to suggest that there might be a problem there. I mean,
until they learned to tax it.
Yeah, that's right.
To make taxes and money off it.
You see, David Noble has written about this. It's called The Corporate Climate Coup is the name of his article. A brilliant article about how the corporations discovered that it was to their advantage to actually go along with it and promote this global warming myth. He's done the history of it. David Noble is a historian at York University, and his article is posted on my blog, activistteacher.blogspot. It's also linked. All these things related to climate are linked or posted on climateguide.blogspot.com.
Hmm.
So he's done a historical analysis of that and has shown how power has shifted and when that happened, and proposed the model as to why that happened. It's quite interesting to look at that.
Yeah.
That's an interesting play on in the States with Al Gore, I think, meant to be the one who can kind of try to ride this wave of global...
Or create it.
And to kind of bring him in as a new puppet for the...
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean...
Well, he himself is in a position to benefit a lot from this through the financial corporation that he set up to exploit this idea of carbon credits.
Yeah.
Well, the only thing that always struck me about Al Gore is that if you look at his voting record when he was in the Senate, you know, he was on environmental issues. He was right in the middle of the road. I mean, there was nothing at all progressive about him. Suddenly this guy's supposed to be, you know, this... ecologist and is supposed to be this, forward thinker on the environment. I'm thinking, well, you know, it's just not consistent at all with his actions, which makes me completely skeptical about everything he says, you know.
The elite is the elite.
What I was going to say, though, when I mentioned earlier about the change in kind of the way that the science is represented in the media is that now it seems that you know, you don't hear about any dissent to the idea of global warming that in the scientific community, and you would assume, there's pretty much widespread agreement as to the science of this, and yet if that's not the case as you're saying, it's interesting how the dissenting views are sort of driven underground or aren't heard at all. I mean.
What they did before, except on the other side.
I think you'll really enjoy climateguide.blogspot.com.
Yeah,
These are all the things that are discussed.
Yeah.
In articles by David Noble and myself.
I was quite shocked. I was doing some research a couple of months ago, and I was actually on the Gaia hypothesis, and I was reading some material on Lynn Margulis, and, you know, she worked with James Lovelock in developing the Gaia hypothesis, and she's quite a prominent biologist and very accomplished. She used to be married to Carl Sagan, by the way, Chris. When I was reading the material on her, I was quite shocked to find that she doesn't agree that HIV causes AIDS.
Right.
Now, this is one of the, you know, most prominent member of the National Academy of Sciences.
Yep.
And she says the evidence just isn't there. I was shocked when I read that.
Well,
again,
it's my opinion that she's right.
Really?
I've been reading the material of a researcher in Ottawa by the name of Brian Murphy, who used to work for Edgar Perez. Anyway, he has reviewed the research on this and has written on it, and he clearly explains that HIV, that AIDS is a problem of poverty.
Mm.
If you're well-nourished and not in poverty, the presence of the AIDS virus in your body will not show any symptoms. You'll live perfectly well. So in other words, it's not about the presence of the virus. It's about the health of your immune system,
yeah.
And it's about your nourishment and your living conditions more than anything. So it's a problem of social justice. It's not a problem of medicine. And of course, there are pharmaceutical companies who stand to make billions if the first world decides to spend public money to fund these drugs in order to give these drugs to the third world, where what they really need is social justice for us to stop stealing from them.
Well, I guess the question.
Wow, it's so funny to just bring it back to that.
Exactly.
It's all related to that. All we got to do is stop robbing them.
That's all we have to do.
It's like Iraq, Iraq. Let them have a stable country, Don't invade them.
It's awful. On
the question of Iraq, and, why don't they do something simple, like have an independent UN commission go in and poll Iraqis and find out what they want?
Yeah.
Do you want the U.S. Army out now, yes or no? Find out democratically what they actually want, and then respect that democratic process.
Or Afghanistan.
But that would be believing in democracy.
Yeah, and that would never happen. I mean, they had no intention of ever leaving Iraq. They wanted military bases there.
Absolutely.
It's written down, Project for a New America.
Yeah,
they have
century,
eight countries they want to take over.
And it's about isolating China as well.
Yeah.
It's about controlling energy resources in order
surrounding them.
Well, surrounding them, yes, and controlling their access to these resources and so on.
It's such a peculiar, I don't understand the whole world economic situation in terms of this vast, vast American debt to China and what the threat of that is, and can that just persist and just be more and more inflated? And I don't know, maybe you have more insight on that, Denny.
Well, I don't like that topic because it's often used in the media to portray China as a danger to America, and it goes along with this fear mongering that we were talking about before.
Mm-hmm.
So that there's that side of the issue that makes me very uncomfortable. But a debt that you have to China, let's say a debt that the U.S. would have to China, is only a problem, A, if you can't pay it, or B, it's only a problem if you can't pay it and you have to pay it. But they could always say, well, we're not paying it. It's just that it would then the third world countries could say, well, we're not paying our debts either. You see, so that's the all of these debts.
Understand, sorry, in the economy, like I hear Alex Jones talks about, the Federal Reserve, they just print more and more money, like they just print the money.
Well, they do.
And they can print any amount they want, and there's no restraint on them, and it just becomes more and more inflated, and its value.
Right.
Why don't they just print a bunch of money and take it to China?
Well, they
do
all the time.
Maybe they can set the printers up in China, say that.
The only reason the U.S. dollar has value is because other countries and other people believe it has value. They see the U.S. as a center of strength, and therefore they want security in the U.S. currency. And so if there's demand for it, it has value. But if they were to switch to the euro, the U.S. currency could be devalued to a small fraction of what it's worth now, overnight.
Yeah.
In fact, there's some analysts who suggested that was one of the reasons for the war in Iraq. I mean, the Iraqis had switched to the euro in terms of the currency that was to be used to buy their oil.
Yeah, I know Connie Fogel, head of the Canadian Action Party, mentioned that specifically in relation to Iran, that it would hit his desire to switch to the euro. I mean, it's like Chavez in Venezuela. We realize what great risk he's at because he's tried to break away from the international financial community.
Right.
Boy, there's such problems in the world. I guess they've been going on. Do you feel, Denny, that we're in like a critical time on the planet where these things are going to move dramatically?
I don't believe this. You know, history goes on.
Yeah.
And there's always been people who have been exploited in different ways, and others who find ways to exploit them, and large institutions and organizations and networks and conspiracies of exploitation and empires. I mean, this has always been the case, right?
Yeah.
But the things that change are the circumstances, the conditions. Technology changes, ways that people communicate. They perfect how to control the mental environment. The structures, the transportation methods, these things change. So you have to, as activists, we have to adapt. We have to find better ways to fight these exploitive structures. We have to constantly be nimble and creative and fight locally everywhere in our lives where we can have the most influence and to try and create justice and democracy. That's what it's about. And that struggle will always be present. There are ups and downs. There are movements. There are changing conditions. It's in different places at different times. There are huge injustices, relatively small ones, but we just have to fight wherever we can to take down hierarchies and work towards an ideal, which would be justice and democracy. But even when I say the word democracy, when you say that to a North American population, most North Americans have no idea what democracy is.
No, they think
we
have
never experienced it.
Yeah.
Corporate selected candidates that you vote for once every 4 years that are part of an elite and that do what they want, that's not democracy. Nothing to do with it.
No.
There are examples of democracy around the world, but we have no experience of it. So it's even hard to explain that. And so in my activism course, I bring people who have experienced democracy and who try to explain what it's about. And that's usually an eye-opener, you know.
Yeah, it kind of begins at a grassroots level.
Yeah. It's about population actually controlling their livelihood and their resources locally and so on.
Yeah.
And having that kind of power.
Yeah.
Economic power. So it is a big challenge.
Just take a few minutes and wind up. If you don't mind, can we just bring it back, Denny? What do you think the next steps are in terms of your process with the University of Ottawa? And I hope that there are students who are going to promote awareness of the issues of your case around the campus there, I would think is really important.
Yes, well, I hope that that your listeners who feel strongly about this experiment at the University of Ottawa will go and look at the freedomofexpress.tripod.com website and possibly sign the petition. That will help with comments, you know.
Yeah.
But I have recently decided that I will offer the activism course in the fall as a protest. Even if I have to give it right in the central administration building in the lobby there, I will give it there.
Wow, good for you.
And I told some of the students that, and they were very excited, and I understand they'll be putting out a press release very soon to announce that.
Wow.
So that's a personal decision that I made. I mean, we've tried everything. We've tried reasoning and asking and gone through all the processes. And for them to act in this way is unacceptable. And so legally, we're in a position where we can have such a protest.
Yeah.
And I will do it. I will do it, you know, with the help of many, many students.
Wow. Just to take back a university in Ottawa, in Canada's capital, you know, just have that shift in one university.
Yeah.
Would be huge.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I know that the students are doing something else as well. They're organizing a conference for the fall, which will be called No Grades, as part of a grades abolition movement.
Oh.
And they're going to invite the absolute best researchers in this area of evaluation and grading, who have argued in their careers that grading is counter to education, that it's a carrot and stick approach, which is more related to making obedient employees rather than actually encouraging learning.
Yeah.
So there's going to be that kind of a conference, which will also be a direct challenge to the institution, you see. There's a lot of excitement around that conference, so that's coming as well.
Yeah, wow, good.
Yeah.
Well, it's nice to be in Ottawa, and I hope to come out and attend some of your classes next year.
Well, you'll be most welcome.
Okay, Jim, did
people,
you have
people come to the classes from as far away as Montreal, Toronto, Washington?
Wow.
Vancouver, there have been people from Vancouver who come to see the class and participate.
Yeah, wow, I can just imagine the excitement in that class.
Yeah, it's very exciting at times.
Yeah. Well, bless you for sticking in there and keeping up this fight and walking the walk. You know, not only talk the talk, you're also walking the walk. And I was very impressed with your confrontative approach with dealing with the university to actually file suit and ask for these resignations, like to really be in their face and not let this slide.
Well, thank you, Christopher. Thank you for that. Thank you both very much for having me on the show.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. And did you have any final thing, Jimmy?
Oh, Denis wouldn't mind, very briefly, have you actually, did I understand that correctly, you filed a suit in, would it be in Superior Court in Ontario?
No, I'm restrained legally to go through my union. It's a legal grievance, but it has all of the same powers of the Superior Court because I'm limited to that, you see.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah,
very interesting.
Good for you.
Good. Don't let them get away with it. I like this, Judge. I like the fact that you're going to present the course even if it's in the administration building. That's great, you know. It's like, it's just the patina that... You know, all these things are glossed over with, just comes off as soon as you confront these people about anything essential. And you know, I wish there were 10 more of you, and maybe, you know, through your efforts, there will be another couple. It starts with from small acorns, great oaks grow. So good for you.
Yeah, thank you very much, Dennis.
They'll have to take me out in handcuffs if they don't want this course.
Okay, well, you've been an inspiration to many there, and thanks, and thanks for your effort.
Yeah, very interesting.
Yeah.
Thank you, guys. Bye-bye
now.
Okay, goodbye. Bye.
Wow, very interesting, Jim.
Wow.
He's in Ottawa, so I have to get out to some classes.
Yeah.
And
a lot of different perspectives on a lot of different matters, you know, and interesting in his explanation about global warming and his position on it, you know, it makes you kind of wonder.
It was funny, my son Tim at Carleton University had a professor there who also gave a talk on global warming.
Oh, really?
He said, I don't know if this is correct, I should have asked Denny about it, but Tim said, his instructor said, all the human CO emissions and only form 4% of the world's CO emissions. In the first place.
Oh.
Because like Mount St. Helens, like, well, eruptions, you know, all the other causes
carbon, forest fires.
Carbon
by the earth all the time, but part of that is, you know, is also from increased warming. It increases the release of carbon and things thawing in the Arctic. But that's very interesting. But as he said, you know, as I mentioned to him, like, a long time ago, I read that article, and it's talking about modeling, you know, what's going on in the planet. And they said the big unknown is water vapor. People don't think of water vapor as the main culprit, but it's very important, and people don't really understand it because they can't model it. It's far too complex to really understand it. But it just goes to show, you know, you have to question authority on everything. And it sure shows
you also, you know, how through the media you can kind of create, okay, now we got to save the planet, everybody. You know, like, all these things are happening. Okay, we got, like, psychopaths over there invading other countries and all these devious things happening in the States with, you know, so many people flooding the borders. Oh, just so many things everywhere, devious in the skies. And meanwhile, you know, everybody's focus now is saving the planet, you know.
Yeah. Well, it's a good focus, but what does it mean? You know, I mean, the planet does need saving. I mean,
there are
massive problems, environmental problems. I mean, he wasn't denying that. He was just saying something completely different about global warming, which I actually agree with him in the sense of you know, you have to look at it in terms of... you know, the environment isn't a thing. The environment is the result of is the outcome of a dynamic series of processes involving human beings and other natural processes. And you know, like, when we talk about it as something static, it's kind of, we put this false misconception that, you know, that it's a thing that needs fixing. But what needs fixing is us. You know, like, we need to change our ways.
Yeah, we got to stop polluting it. We got to stop robbing third world countries.
I was trying to get in there and say that, you know, when he said that and he repeated it near the end of the program, we got to stop robbing the third world. It's like, it's awful. Like, you kind of laugh. I mean, I do, because it's awful in a way. It's an awful reaction, but it's so contrary to our understanding of things and the things that are put out there all the time about what the problems are. That's what the problem is. Stop robbing these people, you know. Stop concentrating the wealth in the hands of a very few people, and everything would change dramatically. I mean, it's not going to happen. I mean, it's such a huge struggle, because these people have so much power and they have so much money, but all these, you know, phony stories are created about what the nature of the problem is. Terror, you know, I'll show you terror. Terror and horror is that these people are thieves, you know, it's just night and day from the way things are represented, and everybody's conditioned to believe that this is this problem. We want to absolve ourselves of any kind of guilt for this, our comfy first world life, but basically it's built on, you know, controlling the resources of the planet and exploiting them way out of proportion to our population, you know?
I mean, it's consistent propaganda, because the average American, I believe, does want to help people in the other parts of the world,
absolutely.
And is generous.
Yeah.
You know, it's the deception of the public is the problem.
I believe
in the basic goodness of American people, as Canadian, as Mexican.
I think people want to do the right thing, but they're so misled as to the nature of the problems that they don't see it. You know, and as he said, I think in the United States there's an incredible misunderstanding about the nature of what their government and their corporate world does overseas in their name, you know, and then they invent these phony cover stories and try to present it as if they're out there doing good things, helping bring freedom and democracy to the rest of the world. Well, the people in the rest of the world know that's just a load, a very big one.
Yeah.
As I
and
say,
then it, to realize you, what a sham our democracy is.
Well,
I mean... It's such a play of puppets and unseen forces.
Yeah, if you read what's happened in Afghanistan, you read an objective analysis. As I said, I recommend the War on Freedom by Nafees Ahmed. he goes through what's happened in Afghanistan. I mean, Canadian troops are there. Canadian troops are there and dying, you know, and American troops and British troops. I mean, you know, I feel awful for these people, their families. You know, we have this big debate here about supporting our troops. Support our troops. Don't send them to these places.
Yeah.
That's how
they
you support
them. They should
never
be going there.
Yeah. I mean, I mean, your son's in the Canadian Army. He might go there, right? I mean,
yeah.
I can't imagine having my son or my daughter die in one of these foreign lands so that Richard Cheney can get richer.
Yeah, you know, really, Halliburton. I mean, it's so ridiculous.
What an abomination. It's just disgusting, you know.
But then to see all the Canadian politicians sell out the public and to maintain this mass deception knowingly.
Yeah. And then
these people are all guilty of treason.
And then these people who are supposed to be experts on this, you know, say, well, it's very complicated. It's not complicated at all, you know. It's stop robbing these guys. The guy had it right.
Yes, that was so,
I have to cut out a little bit early. I have a guy coming to deliver something to me, so I'm going to say goodbye if that's okay, and I'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Okay.
Okay?
Yeah, thanks very much.
Okay, thanks. Okay, bye.
Okay, so, thank you, Denny Rancourt, for coming on today. And I think Denny's situation brings up a much broader issue. This isn't just an issue at the University of Ottawa. You know, I hope people at other universities start demanding more, that you want activism courses. You want courses that give you real education about what's happening in the world. There's so much information out there, especially over the internet. You know, this type of material needs to come into broader public consciousness. I really think we're in an information war. People have to learn the truth. And the more the truth is out there, it's like as it gets out, you can't stuff it away again. And I think it is emerging. And we certainly need to deal with these massive problems we have as the human race. And I say the human race was not meant to turn into a rat race to be controlled by a master race. And in a way, that's what's happened. And people generally, the complexity of it is beyond normal comprehension unless people have kind of studied and researched. So people, you know, let's all keep up the effort. And there's a whole community of us around the world who are trying to bring this greater awareness out into the public forum. I'd like to thank Don and Doug of BBS Radio. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time. I would still, Denny, you're not there, but I'd still argue we are quantum systems. maybe someday talk to Denny about physics. I would say we're quantum systems, and I would say there's a particular quanta within the higher dimensional physics of your heart, and life is a matrix spun around a central point. I believe there's this higher dimensional magic to the origins of human consciousness. Zero point, I explore these teachings of consciousness and the heart, trying to understand the possible physics of higher states and afterlife and other experiences. So I'd like to thank the listener on BBS Radio, and I'll be back in 2 weeks' time. Okay, material points without extension are the materials by which the gods and other invisible powers clothe themselves in bodies. Imagine having such a singular eye, a zero-point center. There's a form of nothingness at the heart of being. This is taught in varied mystical teachings. In the Kabbalah, it's called the Zimzum, that the infinite being withdraws his infinite potencies from a volume of space to allow a finite being to come into existence. So that creates this Zimzum contraction. It creates a hollow within the human heart. And somehow out of the physics of the heart, the magic of life is spun. Thank you. This is Christopher Holmes. 2 weeks' time, I'll be back again. Goodbye.